Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, you will most likely enjoy my Instagram feed. It is instagram.com/KevinRose. You can just search for me on Instagram under the username Kevin Rose. I think you'll like it. It is the place where I post all the trouble that I'm kind of getting into every week. And that trouble varies from week to week. Some weeks I'm attempting to do the splits, which I'm still working on. Got that old 1980s style splits machine that I'm cranking up. If I find that if I could do an extra inch per week, I'm making good progress. It's still going to take me another like year or two until I get to Van Damme status, like full on splits, but I'm getting there. I couldn't touch my toes. I still can't touch my toes. I can touch my toes one at a time. So I can bring kind of one leg up, touch that toe, bring the other one down, but I can't do them together. And that doesn't make any sense, but I don't know. It's the way that my legs work. Anyway, what am I talking about? So I post a lot of crazy stuff on Instagram. I also did a Wim Hof breathing exercise recently on my Instagram TV channel where I taught everyone how to do the Wim Hof breathing exercise, which is this kind of hyperventilating, really intense, like, I don't know, 3 to 4 minute breathing exercise where you get super euphoric and people loved it. Got around 15,000 views so far and a couple hundred comments of people saying how crazy it was. But anyway, you can get all of that chaos and all the fun that I'm having throughout the week or just random things that I'm doing at instagram.com/KevinRose or just search for Kevin Rose. Also wanted to give a quick plug for my meditation app. It is completely free. We're working on the next big release. It's called Oak. You can just do a search in the app store for Oak Meditation. Right now we have a few different styles of meditation that you can practice, including a pretty comprehensive unguided mode where you can get in and set all your different chimes and background music and things like that. And it's been doing quite well. So I've been focusing more of my effort and resources on building out the next version of that, which is going to be a really awesome release coming this fall. And I'll make sure to let you guys know because I'm going to need some beta testers to play around with early versions of that because it is such a massive overhaul. I'd love to get some of you folks in there and kind of kicking the tires and let me know if you find any bugs. Today's show, we're talking to the Minimalists. The Minimalists are a couple guys, Josh and Ryan, that have really kicked off this whole movement of living this more minimal lifestyle that means consuming less things. This is the thing that I think people get confused with. They think when they hear about this kind of movement of a minimal lifestyle or minimal life, they think, oh, this is a person that's, you know, paring down to like just a few pairs of socks and a couple pairs of underwear and they sleep in a tent. That's not what these guys are about. These guys are really about breaking that just natural habit that I think we all have to buy more and more things. And so just how can we be a little bit more thoughtful and actually take control of what we consume? And gosh, I just had this issue today. I was looking at that new iPhone, the XS that was released. I love technology. You know, it's like, it's in my DNA. It's like, it is the thing that I tend to splurge on. And so when there's a new, you know, MacBook Pro or a new iPhone that comes out, I'm always kind of the one that justifies it some way. You know, so I look through the stats and I'm like, well, that camera is a little bit better and I've got this new baby. It's 10 months old. I should probably upgrade. And so I'm always like selling it to myself. And I was definitely doing it this time as well. I was looking through the stats and I was like, well, the apps do launch 30% faster, which is actually something they claimed. Who needs that? Like, who needs 30% faster app launching? It's not like the old days when you were like booting Windows and you had to wait for like 2 minutes. Remember that? You just like sit there and kind of like grab your cup of coffee and wait for your machine to boot up. Like, apps launch pretty damn fast. Anyway, I found myself trying to talk myself into making this purchase. And it's crazy because these things aren't like just $100 anymore. These are like, gosh, some of these iPhones now started $1,000. So it's like buying almost like it's actually spending more than you would on a laptop. Laptops are cheaper than iPhones now, which is just insane. But anyway, I've gone down this path in the past, especially in my 20s and somewhat into my 30s, where I thought that, you know, I was chasing this temporary satisfaction that you get from owning something new. And I did this with cars. I used to like buy a car and say like, oh, that car is so cool. It'll make me feel this much better. And I would buy something and then only end up regretting it like a couple months later. And like, why did I do that? That was foolish. I should sell it now. It's a slippery slope and we are constantly being marketed to, and it's really easy for us to be on Amazon or any one of these other sites and just make this impulse purchase without really thinking it through. And so it's not to say that you can't buy something new, because we all need new things from time to time, but it's just this practice of really breaking out of this this just habit of one-click purchase into something that is a little bit more considered. So I think Josh and Ryan from The Minimalists are the leaders in the space. They certainly kicked off the entire movement. Their documentary on it is amazing. Watch it on Netflix. It's definitely, if you haven't heard of them before, it's the place to go. And they also have a great podcast. I listen to their podcast when I'm at the gym. And there's a lot of great kind of tips and tricks that they have in there to help you kind of slow down in this regard. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you get something out of it. I definitely did. And it was great to meet these guys. I always enjoy meeting people that are really leaders in their space. And certainly these guys are just like the nicest humans. Like there's some, when they first walked in my house, they like both gave me hugs, like just randomly. They're like, well, we like to hug. And just like that kind of like great human connection, great energy. Yeah. So I enjoyed having them on the show. Hope you enjoy this episode.
I'm glad that you guys are here. This is awesome.
Thanks for having us at your home, man.
Yeah, man. This is a beautiful house, man. Yeah, thanks so much for having us on the show.
Yeah, so, you know, for my audience, and I've talked about living a kind of more minimal lifestyle for a while, but you guys kind of started this entire trend, or at least in my eyes, you did.
We are the minimalists because the domain was available for $7.
That's crazy.
So, I wish we could say that we came up with this idea, but I think, you know, because we're the minimalists, people think about us when they think about minimalism.
Yeah.
But this idea has been around for so long, right?
Yeah, I guess like Zen, like masters.
Yeah, go back to the Stoics and it's an answer that's been around for a long time. I think we have a different problem now. And I think, but it's an answer that's been around for a while.
So what was the point where you guys said, I'm going to go buy this domain? Like, what was the tipping point where this felt like, oh shit, like we need to change our lives in some way?
Well, I think it took a while to get there. I stumbled across minimalism through a few folks. There's a guy named Colin Wright. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but at the time he was like this 25-year-old entrepreneur and everything he owned fit in his bag. And there are a few other people like Leo Babalta, Courtney Carver, Joshua Becker. And it was after two events happened in my life. So to back up a little bit, you know, Ryan and I both grew up really poor, like in dysfunctional households, alcohol, drug abuse, no money, food stamps, government assistance. And of course, we thought the reason for our discontent was the lack of money that we had. So when I turned 18, I went out and I got an entry level corporate job. And I spent the next decade sort of just climbing the corporate ladder. And by my late 20s, I'd achieved everything I ever wanted. You know, the 6-figure salary, the luxury cars, the closets full of expensive clothes, and all the stuff, really.
Yeah.
All those things that you're supposed to buy. It's almost like this template, the American dream. We've been sold this meme of the American dream as a template. Like, you follow this recipe, and then of course you're going to get the results of happiness. That's the result I was after. But it turns out that like it wasn't the lack of money that made me discontent growing up. It was like these repeated bad decisions, and making money throughout my 20s just amplified those bad decisions, because now you have money that you can enhance those bad habits. And and so I, along with all the supposed accomplishments, I had a lot of debt and stress and discontent in my life. And two events happened in my life when I was 28 years old. My mother died and my marriage ended, and it was both in the same month. And it was really those two events that forced me to look around and start to question what had become my life's focus. And I realized I was just so focused on all the wrong stuff. And so I started simplifying. I stumbled across, thankfully it was minimalism and it wasn't like, you know, Jonestown or some sort of cult.
Right.
I was just looking for answers. And the first thing I saw was this guy on Twitter who owned 52 items, and that allowed him to travel around the world. And that was interesting to me, although I'm not a big fan of travel, so I didn't want to be like this peripatetic writer. But he said this thing called minimalism allowed him to pursue what he was passionate about. And that was appealing to me. But also it made me start asking more questions, like, who is the person I want to become? What am I actually passionate about? Why have I given so much meaning to all these things? Why am I so discontented, actually? And through that journey of finding these different people who were living minimalist lives, they were all different people. Some of them had families, like Leo Babalta has 6 kids.
Wow.
And lives in San Francisco. And what I realized is I wanted to simplify my life, but my recipe wasn't going to look just like anyone else's. And that was it's both scary because I want another template. Well, give me the 100 things I'm supposed to own and that's what I'll own, right? But the truth is, like, the things that add value to my life are going to be different than what adds value to your life. And so I spent the next 8 months after my mother passed and my marriage ended just simplifying, like jettisoning almost everything. Yeah. And I got rid of about 90% of my possessions over the course of those 8 months. And I started feeling freer and happier and lighter. And then people at work noticed something was different too. People at work started coming up to me and saying, "You seem a whole lot calmer. You seem happier. You seem nicer."
Yeah.
And then Ryan came to me one day and he said, "Why the hell are you so happy?" And so I told him about this thing called minimalism, because I never jumped up and said, "Look at me, I'm a minimalist, and everyone else should be a minimalist too." And so he's like, "Hey, I think I want in on that as well."
Yeah, the biggest difference that I saw in Josh is he started making rules for our boss. Things like, "Hey, I'm not going to answer my phone after a certain time."
It's like office space in a way, basically.
Yeah. I am. That's so funny. Like the hyperbolic version of what we went through. Yeah, absolutely. And I remember the other thing I remember is in Josh's home, he when he moved out with his wife, when they split up, he moved into his new place and he didn't have a lot of stuff. And I didn't really think anything of it. The one thing that stood out, though, was he didn't have a TV. And when I first helped him move into his new place, it came with a wall mount, like already ready for a TV to be in his home. And for us, like, that was something that we always prided ourselves on. Like, do we have the latest, greatest technology? Yeah. How many, how clear is that picture?
Oh,
how many do we have?
I get it. This is like, there's no TV in my main room here.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is we told our builder, because they were putting the house together, like, "Oh, this is where the TV will go. It looks so good. You can put a big TV." And we're like, "We don't want a TV. Like, TV is a treat. We treat it like a treat, where it's like there's a sports game that we want to watch, or some documentary or something that we're into. And that's a once a week, twice a week kind of thing. It's not a daily thing." So
love that. Yeah. It's an interesting approach to this thing that we're supposed to have, kind of on in the background, like a fireplace almost.
Yeah.
And I kept asking Josh, like, "What kind of TV are you going to get? And then eventually he was just like, "I don't think I'm going to get a TV." And it was just these little small changes. And that did cause me to go to him and be like, "Dude, what is going on with you, man? Like, yeah, you have really changed."
Like Suicide Watch. Like, right.
Isn't that weird, though? Like, we as soon as we start giving away stuff, that's supposed to be the telltale sign of someone's going to kill themselves, is I'm decluttering my life. Uh-oh, what's wrong?
Right. One of our coworkers called me and asked that. I mean, they were kind of joking around, but they absolutely did.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, what's going on with Josh? And if it wasn't for Josh, would I have ever have come across the idea of minimalism? I don't know. I like to think I would have. But because Josh and I had been best friends since we were fat little fifth graders, I thought maybe this thing that's working for him, maybe it could work for me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "All right, dude, I want to try this out. I want to be a minimalist." I didn't want to simplify over a 9-month period like Josh had. I wanted faster results. So that's where we came up with this idea of a packing party, where I literally packed up all of my stuff. I pretended like I was moving, and then I unpacked things as I needed it day by day for about 3 weeks. And over this course of 21 days, I was really having and gaining a different perspective on my life. I remember the first thing I unpacked, it was probably like a beer from the fridge, but then it was like all my pacifiers. It was the internet.
Right.
It was the TV. Really started realizing like what I was, kind of doing with my time. And then also realizing how much stuff I had and what I wasn't using. So by the end of those 3 weeks, I mean, I had 80% of my stuff still packed in boxes, and like, it's all sitting in bigger room, like as far as square footage, this, a little bit taller ceilings, but just sitting in this room, just boxes stacked on top of boxes, and all these things that I couldn't even remember, what was in what boxes. And just realizing like, wow, I have spent the last 10 years of my life spending tens of thousands of dollars on this stuff. to make me happy, and none of it's really doing its job. So that's really where the minimalists.com started, is me kind of going to Josh, and I was like, dude, this is an awesome experiment that we should share with other people, because I got a lot out of it. I think other people could get a lot out of this. And Josh had written some essays and stuff. So yeah, we went to GoDaddy, and we started searching for domains. And I remember Josh sent me the idea for the minimalists.com. And I was like, dude, if we call ourselves the minimalists, we are going to be pigeonholed into being the minimalist. And who are we to say, like, we are the minimalist? Because certainly there are, like, monks would put us to shame, right?
Yeah.
Like, so I'm talking to Josh about this, and he's like, well, dude, do you have a better idea? And I'm like, I don't. I don't have a better idea. He's like, well, let's just use this as a placeholder.
It's funny how those stick when you, like, eventually get used to it. And
yeah, so now we own it. And, you know, literally and figuratively, I mean, I'm proud to call myself one of the minimalists. It's an honor to really be, to be looked up as like a role model, just for people to kind of have just something that they can, a recipe that they can look at, and they can say, you know what, Josh and Ryan, they're cool guys. I don't want to live my life exactly like them, but there are some ingredients in their recipe that I can apply to my own life.
Yeah. Let's talk about that recipe, because I'm curious, when you remove things from your life, like, what does that give you? Is the act of having less create the happiness, or is it the less desire? Like, where does the happiness come from, and sure, what are the feelings that occur when someone pares down to the bare essentials?
Well, and what is essential for me is going to be different from what's essential for you. I look at our stuff. The stuff we own is sort of one of three categories. So here's part of the recipe. There are the true essentials. And I think that's probably going to be similar for most people. It'll vary in size and scope.
Toilet paper.
Yeah, we're all going to need toilet paper. We all need a roof over our heads. We need food. We need clothing. But even those things vary, right? And then there's the non-essentials. Those are things that add value to our lives, but you could get by without them. So you could have a really bland life, or you can have these things that augment your experience of life. They enhance or amplify your experience of life, and that's great. Then there's this third category, which should be the smallest, but I think it's the largest, especially in the Western world, and it's junk. It's these things we thought we needed, right? We thought we would like. They're aspirational purchases. It's retail therapy. Mm-hmm. We sort of hear these words. And so we'll buy the oversized orange sweatshirt with tassels because it looked really great on this mannequin. Yeah.
I got one of those all-in-one rice cooker things that does like 30 different things. It doesn't work. I don't know why I bought it. You know what I'm talking about? Hot pot?
Yeah.
The hot pot.
Again, well, that becomes aspirational, right? You're like, well, because it looks like I think I would get value from it, but we don't stop to ask ourselves, will I actually get value from it? And so we have increasing amounts of debt in the United States. You know, the average American has $16,000 worth of credit card debt, has four active credit cards in his or her wallet. One in 10 Americans has 10 or more active credit cards. I was one of them. I had 14 credit cards. Wow. Because I'd be stupid not to sign up for the Banana Republic card,
right,
and get 15% off the shirt that I'll wear three times. And then, of course, you're compelled to keep going back there and going further into debt.
The aspirational stuff is tricky, too, because I feel like that is where some mental burden like hits you. That says, I have to one-up someone else. Mm. I have to, you know, have a better car, and then I have to eventually get a private jet, and then I have to eventually, you know, so you're always trying to feel internally like you don't have enough, like you need to be able to afford something bigger and bolder to make yourself seem worthwhile.
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel like we all have to have some type of purpose that we're aiming for, some kind of direction that we're aiming for.
Yeah.
And the things that you mentioned, one-upping keeping up with the Joneses, or one-upping our friends or coworkers, that is one way to focus our time and energy and our other resources. It's like I said, I think that is probably the easy way to go. Just if you look at evolution, like being on top, like that's how you survived. I mean, at a certain point, like that was survival. I think that there are also many other ways that we can still find purpose and we can still find a direction to head in.
Yeah.
And the pursuits that that you mention, those are, it's funny because we are raised being told that money doesn't buy happiness, but we all just want to try it out for ourselves.
Right.
Like just
only
to make
sure. For me, baby.
Right, right. And the problem is that money solves money problems and that's it. It doesn't really do much more than that. Yes, it does solve your money problems, but there are still, you know, problems or things that you have to face with relationships or with community or whatever it may be. So I think minimalism, for me, it really helped me to refocus my resources, not just my money, but my time. That was the number one reason why I got into it, is I saw an opportunity. When I was sitting there in that room with 80% of my stuff still packed in boxes, I just thought to myself, if I didn't buy any of this, like, A, I would be closer to being out of debt. I'd be closer to retiring early. I wouldn't have to work 60, 70, 80 hours a week to maintain this consumeristic lifestyle. So for me, it was about, I mean, honestly, man, I wanted to get to a point where I was debt-free and I was able to live off a barista's salary. And for me, that sounded like, and it still does. I mean, one day I hope to get to that lifestyle where I'm just, you know, working 30 hours a week being a barista. But for me, it was, you know, having that 30 hour a week job, but having the other time during the week to pursue things that I really, really loved and that I really, really enjoyed.
Kevin, you moved recently, and yeah. I heard the random show you did with Tim recently, where you're talking about getting rid of one thing a day.
That's right.
And I don't think the act of getting rid of the stuff brings you sort of long-term happiness or contentment or well-being, but I think it's an important first step for many yeah. of us, right? Where it's like, this stuff has gotten in the way.
Right.
And so it seems to me like when you were talking about letting go of one thing a day, it wasn't because, I mean, yeah, you sort of feel this weight lifted right away, but
sure.
but that is merely the first step. It's making room for what is more important, you spending time with your daughter or your family. Or, I mean, when I come into your house, which is a relatively new house, I feel a sense of calm. People often associate like tiny house living with minimalism, and that's one side of it.
Yeah.
But that's never been as appealing to me personally, because I think the better question is like how many square feet are your house, is like what's the appropriate amount of space for me and my family. Mm-hmm. Right. We had a architect in our documentary, a minimalist architect, his name is Frank, and one of the things that I was asking him about was, well, how does he go about building a house for someone? He said, I never asked people, do you want a living room? Do you want three bedrooms? Do you want a three-car garage? Do you want a dining room? Because people just say yes to everything. I'm supposed to have this. He said, instead, I ask people how they live their life, and I try to build a house around that. Because if I don't do that, you're just going to cram someone else's life into that house.
Right.
You're going to try and fill every corner sort of thing. And then 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, you look around and you realize like, oh, I've got all this stuff. The average American household has 300,000 items in it.
That's insane.
And it doesn't happen overnight. And I think the same thing is true with the simplifying. That simplifying thing doesn't happen overnight either. That's why I like the idea of you're gaining momentum, because getting rid of one item a day turns very quickly into like, you know what, like I've got this momentum now, I can get rid of 10 things today. Or
yeah, and it also helps you kind of reframe in your head when you're about to make another purchase. You're like, is this something I'm going to have to eventually give away because it's a bad purchase?
Right. What's the true cost of the thing?
We
often think of the price tag as the cost, but it's like taking care of the thing, worrying about the thing. There's a psychological way, putting fuel in the thing, changing the thing's batteries, changing the oil in the thing, cleaning the thing. There's like all of these extra costs that we don't think about at the point of sale.
Yeah, that's right.
The other thing too about letting go, or practicing letting go, like one thing per day, like that gives you the ability to let go of more things. And like the biggest, I think, superpower that Josh and I have been able to gain from this life that we've lived in the last, you know, 10 years is the power to walk away from anything. And I mean, you know, as Mariah, my partner, she could, you know, call me and be like, oh man, Ryan, the apartment spontaneously combusted and I was able to get out and I got our cat, but everything else is totally gone. I wouldn't even flinch. I'd be happy that they were safe.
Yeah.
But it is through practice. It's not like I just woke up one day and was like, you know what? This minimalism thing sounds great and I'm just going to let go of everything.
Yeah.
It was definitely a process, but through this process, getting that ability to walk away from anything is really powerful. That's, to me, that's freedom.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, one of the things when I first was introduced to this, before I watched your documentary, which is amazing, by the way, I loved it.
Thank you.
It was probably when my father passed and he left all of his stuff to the family. And I'm like going through this and looking at all his stuff and I'm thinking, wow, so much of this meant something to him, but means nothing to me.
And now you're burdened by it.
Yeah, and now I'm burdened by it. And it's also just like, what good is this doing now? It's just like he's gone. He can't take it with him. You know, it's right. Like, why have all these things that it's weird. Is it just in his head, these were valuable, but not to anyone else's. I couldn't even sell them. We tried to do like a garage sale and like a lot of the stuff was just, he got in the habit of buying things, you know, just like, it's an addiction. I feel like,
yeah,
especially have you met people that are addicted to buying things? Like for me, it was Amazon. I was just like, oh, you know, it's late at night and you're like, oh, they're doing this little deal thing. Or it also recommends this, which are scary accurate these days.
Yeah.
You must have run into people that have these addictions around buying stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, what is the stat, Josh? $1 trillion are spent on non-essential goods?
Yeah, $1.2 trillion. So we spend about $250 billion a year on charitable giving. And we spend $1 trillion more than that on non-essential goods, you know, cheap plastic shit from Walmart, basically. Yeah. And it's because we're addicted. You ask, have I ever met anyone like that? Absolutely. But it started with like meeting the guy in the mirror and realizing that was my addiction. You know, my mother had, you know, her serious addictions with alcohol abuse and that's one type of addiction. Mine was sort of more austere, but it was still like, and I could hide it better with massive amounts of debt. You know, I had nearly $500,000 worth of debt by my mid-20s.
Wow.
And yeah, part of that was mortgage.
You got out of that?
Yeah. Well, I did. It took about 5 years of really significant planning and, you know, sort of rice and beans diet and being focused on paying off the debt, moving into a smaller house, selling things. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it wasn't bolted down, it was pretty much going to go in order for me to become untethered from that life.
Yeah.
But don't get me wrong. I don't think there's anything wrong with stuff either. I think we all need some stuff. And that's one of the big misconceptions here. It's like,
yeah,
Ryan and I are telling people to go out and be ascetics or monks or stoics. Not necessarily. I mean, what we're saying is we're not trying to live outside of this consumerist world. We're trying to be conscious consumers. We all have to consume some stuff. I'd rather do that intentionally, and that's the paradox of minimalism, is I get far more value from my things now than if I were to water them down with 300,000 things.
Yeah, that's interesting. You're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, I've had this personally where as I pare back more things, the things that I do hold on to mean more to me, you know, and that's a really cool feeling, like just things that objects that are special to me in some way. And, you know, I have, you know, a few watches cause I was involved with a watch company. I like the idea of the craftsmanship of watches, especially when it comes to like these old watchmakers that are dying off. I have a few now, and there's one in particular that's made in Japan. Nobody would ever know it, but it was made by a small little group of individuals and I was able to find it. It took me a long time. It's the one thing that I looked down and I'm like, this is one of my favorite possessions.
That's great.
But it's not like about, you know, it's not a brand that anyone would ever recognize if you wear it. And it's more about my personal like affinity to that and that my love for the craft.
Right.
Which I think is a really powerful thing. How do you guys make decisions when you purchase things?
No, I think it's very similar to that. I mean, you don't have 1,000 watches.
Right.
You've got some watches that you really appreciate the craftsmanship of. It's art.
Right.
In a way. And it's art that you really, really appreciate. I mean, when it comes to those hobbies, that's how I look at it. Or some hobbies I have that serve the things that I have actually serve a purpose. Like I snowboard. So, you know, all the stuff I have that goes along with that. I absolutely have one pair of, you know, snow pants and a pair of gloves, and I don't have multiple pairs of pants and multiple pairs of gloves. I have exactly what I need.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, man, I wish I could sit here and say that, you know, if all your listeners, they went and watched our documentary, they bought all our books, they will never want to buy anything again. I mean, that's just, yeah, that's just not the case. That's not what we're, that's not what we're offering. I still, as one of the minimalists, I still enjoy buying stuff. I mean, it's still an impulse that I have been able to rein in, but I still have.
Yeah. I hope there's a TMZ somewhere of you with like a Prada bag or something. Like, that would be amazing.
That'd be so good. You know what's funny, man, is as the minimalist, everything we do is steeped in irony. I mean, it is, yeah, the irony is not lost with us. Like, you know, when 2,000 people will show up at one of our events, or, you know, people who download our podcasts or whatever. Like, there's so many things steeped in irony with us. But what I was going to say, though, about me still wanting to buy stuff is, I remember I have this these pair of overalls that's like a snow, they're for snowboarding. And like going on the hunt for those, it's not that I was getting some kind of like fix off of it, but I really enjoyed the experience of like comparing different overalls and reading the reviews and like really making this deliberate decision, mm-hmm, with buying a pair of these overalls that I know are going to last me, you know, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And finally getting it. And I remember like being on the mountain and wearing those for the first time. And it's crazy. Like, I just didn't even realize until having this pair of overalls, like I'm standing up on the mountain, I'm like, wow, like having comfortable equipment for going down a mountain on a snowboard, it is a game changer in a lot of ways. So we certainly do appreciate stuff, especially, you know, art, and there are many different crafts that I can definitely appreciate. But what it comes down to is what actually does add value to my life. Like, Kevin, you're an awesome dude. And there are many, like, I love your house, man. There's a lot of things. I'm like, man, Kevin's, I would love to, you know, have a really simple house like this. I mean, I know it's a big house, but it's a very simple home. I can tell that things are done very deliberately. But I could very easily be like, man, Kevin's a cool guy. I want to be like Kevin. I want to start collecting watches. And like, those are the things that I think we have to look out for. That's what I have to look out for, is really asking why do I have this impulse? If I act on this impulse, what is that going to do for me? What's it going to do for my household, the people around me? I think minimalism helps us to ask those maybe extra questions, maybe not deeper questions, but extra questions.
What prompts you? Like, when do you find that those come up? Are there certain times where you guys feel like, oh, I'm catching myself? Like, this is something that, like, how do you teach people? I guess, like, obviously your books probably explain this, but how do you teach people? What's the first steps to get started?
Well, I think the very first step is asking a question. And that question for me was, how might your life be better with less? And because it reframes it. It reframes in the way that you identify what the benefits are. Because getting rid of the stuff, like we talked about a moment ago, is that's not the happiness. How might your life be better with less? Like, you'll answer that question differently from Jordan over there, different from Ryan, different from me. And that highlights what the benefits of simplifying might be for you. For me, it was getting out of debt. But then I uncovered all these other additional benefits, like improved relationships, because I started getting rid of toxic people in my life, or people who just didn't share the same values. Maybe they weren't toxic, but
interesting. You can apply this to people too.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's equally important, right? But when it comes to like, what are the first steps? That's an important one. When it comes to bringing new things into my life, though, I have some sort of stop gaps there. We have something called the 30-30 rule, and so if something costs more than $30, I wait at least 30 hours to buy it. That's especially helpful with Amazon. Because it's so easy. And it's not that I don't have the money. I can blow $30 on something, but it makes me at least stop and say, okay, does this thing, or will this thing, add value to my life? Will it serve a purpose or bring me joy? And then also I'm asking myself, is this the best use of that $30? Because maybe I can justify, yeah, it's going to add value to my life, but maybe there's a better use of this $30 or $100 or $2,000 or whatever it may be. Is this the best use of that money? Mm. And quite often the answer is no. Like, this is a good use of the money, but I'd rather do something else with it. And just that pause allows me to ruminate in what I'm about to do. And I'm on the precipice of my next bad decision here. Let me stop and pause before I leap off of this cliff. Or after those 30 hours, if I'm like, yeah, definitely have decided this is the right thing to bring into my life. Great. And the same thing is true when I'm letting go, because even now at age 37, I've been a minimalist for about almost 10 years now. And the things that added value to my life when I first embraced this lifestyle at 28, radically different now. You know, I've got a 5-year-old, I have a partner, we live together, we're in a different city. And so I realized, like, oh, the things that add value today may not add value tomorrow. So I also have to be willing to let go of the new things I bring into my life so I can make room for whatever the future might hold.
Yeah. How do you, you mentioned you have a partner in your life. You guys both do. I'm sure you get this all the time. Somebody has a partner that's like not bought in.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you do if your partner wants
we will get someone who asks us the question, how do I make my partner a minimalist?
Right.
And that's,
how do I force them into this lifestyle?
First, watch the documentary.
Right, right. Exactly. Just have them, buy all our books and watch our documentary and they'll become a minimalist. No, the only thing people hate worse than change is when people try to change them. So forcing someone to do anything is definitely the wrong approach.
Yeah.
So Mariah, when I first met her.
You guys don't count though, because they know what they're getting into.
Yeah, she did. But what I'll tell you though is she wasn't a minimalist though. Like when I first met her, she had 60 pairs of shoes. I mean, she had a lot of stuff. She did pair, like when we moved in together, she respected my values and my beliefs, and we have similar values and beliefs.
What do you do when you're dating? And you like go out for dinner, and you're like, don't get the lobster.
No, but see, you know what though? Like, it's not about how much, minimalism does not necessarily mean frugality.
Right.
It's not about being cheap.
You're cool with the extra, hot fudge.
If anything, it's like, I won't buy, the latest and greatest snowboard so I can free up that resource so I can go out and spend money and have a nice experience on a nice dinner or something.
Experiences are huge, aren't they? Like, there's absolutely a lot of value there.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's really what Mariah and I focus on is having great experiences together. She has pared down over time. I understand, like, she knew that I was one of the minimalists. Although when we first met, like, I just send her, we did this talk in Seattle about an hour and a half long. And I was like, you can watch this video or we can talk more in person. And she ended up watching it. So it's not like she really knew, she knew what I was about, but she didn't know about me before we started dating. But what I'm getting at though, is that because we respect each other, because we love one another, because we go out of our way to support one another, like she makes sure that her things aren't spilling into the common areas. And I think when it comes to couples who, maybe one's a little bit more of a minimalist than the other, it's not about forcing someone to do something as much as it is like showing support and showing respect for each other. That's really how you get someone to do anything for you. I know with Mariah,
that's just any healthy relationship.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
no matter,
exactly,
if it's minimalism or anything else.
100%. If I go to Mariah and I say, "Hey, honey, could you make sure to like cook more or whatever?" Right. Like, that's not going to motivate her to do that thing more. Now, if I go out of my way to say, "Hey, you know what? I'm going to cook tonight," and or I'm going to help you cook, and I show my support and I go out of my way to show her that I love her and that I'm not just, trying to change her, like, that is going to make her want to do more things for me. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, when she goes out of her way to make sure that her stuff isn't spilling into the room and she's going out of her way to respect me, I do likewise. But yeah, you're right. That's just basic good rules to have with any relationship, minimalist or no minimalist.
Yeah. How do you guys treat technology? Because I'm curious, like when we first sat down, I was like, "Hey, you got the Oura Ring. You should check out my new version." And you were like, "Yeah, I kind of like mine."
Well, I do. I mean, I got this because of you. You send out that really useful journal.
A little coupon code there. I had on something like that.
Yeah. And I mean, I use it to track my sleep and I like the way this one looks. I saw the new one that came out. And of course, I got that twinge of, well, of course, I need to buy the new one. Right. And then I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like, aren't you getting value from this one? And am I going to get an equal amount of more value by upgrading or whatever? And I mean, I think it's one of the things that we get caught up in, is we get caught up in that cycle of needing to upgrade. And technology does.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
Technology, like every time there's a new iPhone, I'm always just like, oh, I probably should get that.
I still have a 5, And it's like, the 10's awesome. Like the camera is like, that's the one thing where I'm like, well, it does have a better camera.
Well, the camera is so like, it's important. It is really important.
You have a 10 month old, right?
Right. Exactly. So, I'm doing the portrait mode and all that crazy stuff. And it's just like,
right. But somehow our parents got by without it.
Right. And although I don't have any photos of myself, like only a handful, you know?
Well, I mean, and that's the thing. The question then becomes like, is it about the utility of the tool, and then am I going to get commensurate value with the amount of money that I spend on it? And if so, that's great. Then feel free by all means. Minimalism is not about deprivation. I don't want to deprive myself, although sometimes temporarily I will deprive myself of something to see whether or not it truly adds value to my life, mm-hmm. or am I just justifying this? I remember there was a period of time, so when my marriage ended, and I went without a TV for a while, like Ryan talked about, and then I moved into an even smaller apartment because I was working really hard to pay. I moved into this $500 a month apartment, and I was working really hard to pay off all my debt. And when I moved, it was during the weekend, and so I couldn't switch over the internet to my new house. And I said, "Oh, I'll just go this weekend without it." And it was a pretty productive weekend. And I said, "Okay, I'm just going to do an experiment. I'm going to go a month without home internet." And that month turned into 5 years.
Oh, wow.
I didn't have home internet for 5 years.
Wait, now you have a cell phone that has internet.
Well, sort of. So the next experiment I did a few months into that is I got rid of my cell phone for, and this is my BlackBerry back in the day. I got rid of my cell phone for 2 months. And so I came home, no television, no internet, no cell phone. And you learn a special kind of loneliness.
Yeah.
Because all those pacifiers that we reach for, I'm going to go from this Bermuda Triangle of TV to cell phone to internet, da-da-da-da-da, keep going from one to the other, that was gone. And I mean, I rediscovered these things called books. They're amazing.
Yeah.
And
how did friends get a hold of you? I had a pager.
There were two pay phones. Maybe they're still there in Dayton, Ohio. So you didn't really get a hold of Josh. He would get a hold of you.
Yeah. Or they would stop by and knock on the door. Yeah. And
isn't that a weird concept?
Yeah. You learn a lot about your friends too. Like if we're supposed to meet at a coffee shop at noon, I would wait around until 12:05 and I just leave like, oh, I guess they're not showing up. And there was no way for them, hey, I'm running a few minutes late or whatever.
Yeah.
And it makes us be a little bit more mindful. Eventually, I brought the phone back in because I realized, yeah, I'm depriving myself. But I use it differently now. I don't have any social media apps on my phone.
Who posts your account? Because you guys have a great Instagram account.
Thank you. you can thank Jessica Lynn Williams for that. She's nice. Awesome. She does all of our social media full time. So all the words are from us and she curates the photos on like Instagram. And then, you know, we meet with her every week and we talk about what we're trying to accomplish. But even with social media, we decided to do something completely different this year. We started using social media differently because I found we accidentally were like posting everything in triplicate. It's all right, well, I'll post this photo on Instagram and then I'll repost it on Facebook and then I'll repost it on Twitter.
Yeah, it's very confusing as to which one you're supposed to do. Yeah, well, I still have that problem. I think we all do.
Yeah.
Well, so on our website, there's this essay from the beginning of this year called How the Minimalists Are Using Social Media in 2018. We sat down with Jessica and we said, okay, we want to use these platforms more intentionally. So what is the best use for each one of these platforms? Let's use it that way. And Instagram was obviously like, let's post beautiful photos with short captions, maybe a short essay or like a pithy little maxim of ours and accompany that with a photo.
It's all grayscale. It's cool.
Yeah, yeah. And it alternates black and white, like dark to light. She does a great job curating that. But then Facebook, like we found that people were getting the most value from the articles we would share. So if we find something, wherever, Fast Company, that's about, it's not necessarily about minimalism, but it could be minimalism or minimalism adjacent, you know, something about intentionality, then we'll post the articles on Facebook. And then with Twitter, like that's the best platform for just text. No links.
Sure.
So we don't post any links on Twitter. We don't post any photos on Twitter. It's only text. And it's a great way to communicate with people as well, just via text. Mm-hmm. And so we use those differently. We just started using YouTube. That's why we have Jordan here. He's our full-time filmmaker now, and so we're doing a video version of the podcast, but our videos go to YouTube, right? As opposed to like, well, it's got to have a home here. Now, that those constraints actually I found have made us more creative. They're also they're frustrating at times, but in a good way, because it makes you sort of problem solve and figure out, okay, how am I going to get around this constraint so that I can effectively use these platforms to communicate with people?
I like how thoughtful that is. I feel like so many people just treat social media as like, I created one piece of content, now it's blasted everywhere, you know? And like, you do get those duplicates and you start seeing stuff and you're like, I don't know, where should I follow them? And right. That's smart.
And I also understand that you might not be on all platforms or any platform, and that's okay. And we always encourage people to unfollow us. That's one thing that we've been doing for a lot of years now. Anytime you stop getting value in what we're putting out there, I won't be offended if you unfollow. I totally understand that. In fact, if you feel like we're adding to the noise, that's not what we want to do. Please remove us from the noise. What we're trying to do is use those platforms in a way that are very noisy, but people are eager to, you know, find what we're whispering in the noise.
Do you guys have any experience with like technology fasting, like detoxes around technology? Like, one of the things that I'm really concerned with, you know, I look at my niece and she's 15, and like, if you take her cell phone away from her, she just goes ballistic. Like, tears start flowing and you're just like, you know, it is, she's glued to it in a way that like I never was, like really intense, but she's also grown up with it where we didn't have those when I was a kid. What are your thoughts on this need for constant stimulation, and how do you guys find balance there?
Yeah, I think that the tools, the technology that's introduced into our lives, I mean, a tool is as good as its user. And, you know, you can take you can take a hammer and hammer a nail with it, or I can bludgeon Josh over the head with it. I mean, there are two different, or a lot of different ways to use a hammer. So, I think that when these things get introduced, we're not Luddites. We don't want to shun new technology, but with something like minimalism, it is a philosophy that can help someone to use their equipment a little bit more intentional. It is scary though, man. Like, when I think about teenagers and how they'll be in the same room, not talking, but
texting.
They'll be texting.
Yeah. I've heard that. It's crazy.
And to your point of this stimulation, I mean, dude, the human brain is built for stimulation. We love stimulation, man.
Yeah.
So the more that this technology comes out, the more companies are trying to stimulate our brains to get our attention. So,
but then, nighttime rolls around and you shut off your device and all of a sudden your brain's been going and it wants more.
Yeah.
And then we start using our devices in bed and it's just slippery slope.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, there are a few rules there you can put in place. Like, my partner and I won't use any screens in the bedroom. Like, no TV in the bedroom, no phones in the bedroom. But the concept you're talking about here with 15-year-old being constantly on their phone, it reminded me of a few things. One is, there was this art exhibit I saw of a bunch of photos of people. This photographer took photos of families who were on their phones, but then photoshopped the phones out of their hands, and we look crazy. I mean, we truly, you imagine the three of us just sitting here, if we were all on our hand, just staring at our blank hands, people would think we had some sort of mental disorder.
Oh, for sure.
And my doctor calls this the medium cognitive load. I did a podcast with him. We were talking about health problems, and one of the things we talked about was this link between mental health and constant stimulus. But he was talking about how one of the worst ways to work out is just run at that medium pace, a 6 or a 7, for hours on end, right? It's not the best thing for your body. But we're doing the same thing to our minds with the constant stimuli. It's the opposite of, are you familiar with Cal Newport, Deep Work?
Deep Work, the book.
Yeah, he's a professor at Georgetown.
I have it on Audible, but I haven't listened to it yet.
Okay, you'll love it. And he on his blog, check out his blog too. He writes a lot about digital minimalism. He also has a great TEDx talk called Quit Social Media. And he's not a Luddite. He's younger than us for sure. He's late 20s, early 30s, but has never had a social media account, and writes very eloquently as to why. He's not shunning technology. In fact, he's embracing different types of technology to allow him to do more deep work, as opposed to that the medium cognitive load, where you can stimulate yourself for 20 hours a day, but is it meaningful?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to these new technologies, I mean, with kids, it's like, as a parent, you don't want to have to order your kid around, like tell them exactly what to do, when to do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's so easy for me to say this, not being a parent too. But, you know, I steal this from Joshua Becker. He's got a great book, Clutter-Free with Kids. But I totally am stealing from that, where he talks about how you don't want to tell your kids what to do, but you do want to set some boundaries. And I think like that with the 15-year-old, I mean, you don't want to take their phone away forever.
Right.
But, you know, maybe some boundaries do need to be set. But I think about not just if I have kids, but with myself. I mean, Josh was talking about how him and Bex don't have, you know, screen time in bed. And it's, you know, Mariah and I setting these boundaries for ourselves, implementing these rules, it allows us to have the household that we want. And yeah, if we have kids in our lives, like we're gonna, you know, set those boundaries for them as well. But certainly with all of the devices we have to stimulate us, we do have to have some boundaries. Because yeah, if we don't, then it gets out of control and we end up...
Even as adults, we need to have them, you know?
It's absolutely.
Like, I try to find a little bit of time just to be bored. And I think of people think of bored as like, it's such a negative word. They're just like, oh, to be bored. Oh, that sounds horrible.
It's got a connotation.
Like, right. Exactly. So yeah. I actually like that. People think it's negative. I'm like, well, I want to go do that and see what that feels like.
I love that.
And
man,
like, maybe like embrace that and see if it takes me in a different direction or a different space in my head. And so, you know, if we could just all sit around and be a little bored, you know, Mr. Rogers did this great thing where he was on TV and he's like, kids, what is a minute like? What does it mean? What does it mean to be a minute? And he started a timer and they literally on television watched a clock go around for a minute. And then when it was up, he's like, there you go. That's a minute. It's like, can you imagine? Yeah. Like,
kids, it would not fly today.
It would not fly today at all.
It's funny. I was just at the Portland Art Museum this morning and there's this photographer, Robert Flick, which, by the way, Flick is a great last name for a photographer.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
He had to have changed that at some point, right?
I know, right? But he's from Canada, I believe, but moved to Los Angeles and still lives in Los Angeles. But he spent 2 years when he first moved there photographing a parking structure for 2 years.
Wow.
And the photos, I walked around the whole museum this morning, and they were the most striking out of all the photos there. There are no cars and no people. He made sure he photographed this parking garage. It's a massive parking garage, only when there were no cars and no people present. And I connected this because the boredom thing, like, there is a certain banality in that, this parking structure, but there's also beauty mm-hmm. in the banality. And then I think the opposite is also true. We're so overstimulated, you know, by these things that seem extraordinary. An iPad? That's magic to someone from 100 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
But it's so extraordinary, but there's banality in the extraordinary as well, because if we're constantly passing, I mean, now we just see people, there's the famous sort of memed video of this little baby who encounters a print magazine for the first time, and she's just puzzled because she can't figure out how to swipe left on the magazine cover because the stupid print magazine is not swiping. And so it's a weird thing how we've developed this extraordinary world, but it's not as extraordinary as we thought. And there are, I mean, I was blown away by these photos of a damn parking garage because of the light and the angles and the structure and the surfaces. And there was something just beautiful about the banal.
Yeah, there's something really awesome about getting your focus and your attention and putting it on something and having that be like your presence on that thing. When I was in Japan one time, I was walking down this alleyway and I saw this old man outside, and he was polishing his mailbox like slowly by hand.
Yeah.
And the one thing I love about Japan is just like, you can eat off the ground, like everything. There's like this sense of just like deep care about every object that you own. And this man was taking something. I'm like, this is going to take this guy like half the day to do just his mailbox. But the intention and the focus and this, the mindfulness around polishing the mailbox, I was like, I want to go home and polish my mailbox. That's amazing.
Yeah. No, I love Japan. I was in Tokyo. Mariah and I were last year, and golly, like, it's kind of forced minimalism in Tokyo because it's so big and like so many people crammed in this huge area. But because there's so many people stacked on top of each other, like you have to be kind of creative with different solutions. And yeah, I totally agree, man. Like that is like a, probably like the most minimalist culture.
Yeah, yeah, and I just respect for your objects, like the things that you own. You mm-hmm. can tell everyone just really respects their space, you know, and their cars, and everything is just really tidy and clean. And I, there's something about that.
I think part of that has to do with the not going overboard with materialism. Or in our documentary, Juliet Shore, she said something that really stood out to me. She said, the problem with our culture is maybe we're not materialist enough. Like we treat everything as just discardable. I mean, if you go to a mm-hmm. place like H&M, they have 52 seasons. You know, we used to have two seasons a year. It was hot and cold, right?
Right.
You dress for the hot weather with fewer clothes. You dress for the cold weather with more clothes. And now it's 52 seasons.
Wow.
It's a new clothing line or new display every single week with new clothes. And so we're not materialist enough in a way because we don't care about the objects we bring into our lives. And caring is different from attachment. And I think that's important. I can care for the things I own. I can have a very well curated house. We do something called living room conversations on our YouTube channel, and we do it in my living room. And I think if you walk in my house, you're not going to say, "Oh my God, this guy's a minimalist." You'd just be like, "Wow, this family is really tidy."
Right.
And it's because we don't own a whole lot, but everything we own sort of has a function in our house, or it has an aesthetic beauty, or ideally both. You want something that has both form and function. And so I have some beautiful objects, but also if you know, the place catches fire, I'm going to be okay.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I like that. And I've been getting more into that lately, is just this idea of being able to buy something that I can care for a very long time. In terms of like how you address and care for these things, like, and also the non-attachment piece, I think is another big piece of it as well. There was, I think it was a Zen teaching where they talked about someone had a very old mug that they just absolutely loved, like their favorite mug for their tea. And when they knocked it off the shelf, it broke. And rather than saying and looking at that and being devastated because it's your favorite mug that you've had for 20, 30 years, whatever it may be, they thanked it for the time that it served them.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just so cool. And it's like, it's to put your point about like, you can care about the things, but if your house goes up in flames, you know, you're okay.
Right.
You know, and you can thank all those items. I think there's something really cool about like giving items. You know, The Magic of Tidying Up. Did you guys read that book?
Yeah. Marie Kondo. Yeah.
That was a, that was a really cool one because you like give these items a little bit of life. Like if you get rid of your socks and you're like, thank you. Like you're no longer serving me. So I'm going to pass you on to someone else. It's like when you give something up, you know?
Sure.
I like doing that to food as well. Like if you have like a chicken that you cooked, you can say like, I don't say a prayer, but I will look at it and say, I thank you for your life. Like you did a good service and like you're now dead and I'm going to enjoy you, but like, thank you for living, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's something to be said about humanizing things like that.
Yeah.
That help us create a better connection with it and appreciation. And, you know, the example of saying thank you to a broken cup. I mean, it's also that closure that we need with stuff. A lot of the times I think we have that need to hold on to certain things because we feel like if we let it go, we'd let it go with no closure. And
right.
Humanizing it can help us with that even.
Yeah, that's a great point. I don't want to take up too much of your guys' time, but I would love to know what you've been up to lately. Like what's the latest book? Like where are you guys taking this? You've been doing it for so long now.
Yeah, it's been about 8 years now. We started December 2010. And it was right with Ryan's packing party. I never intended this to be like our full-time gig. I wanted to write fiction. In fact, when I left the corporate world, it was to write fiction full-time. And then,
and I want to be a barista. I mean, eventually this is going
to
happen.
Yeah. come to Portland, man. There's great coffee shops here.
We have our second documentary coming out, hopefully toward the end of this year.
Oh, awesome.
And so it's, we have been describing it. I don't know if this is accurate. It's both a prequel and a sequel to our first documentary. It's a much more deeper dive into sort of our backstory. We went back to Dayton and sort of the houses we grew up in and talked about the discontent there. And then of course the discontent of our 20s mirroring that, but in a sort of Kafka-esque mirror. And so that's really the next thing. We focus on one project a year, and that's it. Everything else sort of serves that, whether it's the podcast or social media or our blog.
How long does it take you to film a documentary?
The first frame of that was filmed in December of 2013, and we released it the summer of 2016. But most of that was actually filmed in 2014, the vast majority of it. And then we did some test screenings. We did a theatrical release with it. You learn a lot of lessons from that, like don't put a documentary out in theaters.
Yeah.
It did really, really well in theaters, but really well for a documentary in theaters is not great. But then once you get it on a platform like iTunes or Netflix or something like that, you know, you've got the power of the internet behind you. And it spreads a lot easier that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, with this, with Less Is Now, we filmed the bulk of it the beginning of this year, and then kind of some more interviews throughout. We just literally got the first version back like less than a week ago.
Oh, cool.
So it's looking really good. We might have to film maybe one or two more scenes. I'm really excited. We're sending it. We just sent it off to get scored. So that first documentary we had, there was a band called We. They do, it's capital V, capital V, capital E. So it looks like We. A guy named Andrew Kapaner and Nate Pfeiffer. Just amazing. That's my favorite part of the whole documentary of that first one was the music, was the soundtrack.
Yeah.
So they're going to score the second one. That's so awesome. Yeah, we're excited, man. That should, we don't have like an exact release date, but end of this year, beginning of next year.
Sweet. Great. We'll have to.
We're excited.
So are you going to do any theater release or no? Just straight to.
We might do more limited things. We did 400 theaters last time, and like the amount of legwork that goes into doing 400 theaters is not worth the time and effort. You also learn very quickly about the term Hollywood math. There's a million different people who have their hands in the pot when you do something like that. So yeah, we'll probably do some sort of limited release, and we've gone on 9 tours in the last 8 years. So I'm sure we'll do some tour stops around that.
Yeah. Well, if you guys want to do one in Portland, I hosted the, an early release of the new Mr. Rogers documentary.
I still
up
haven't
here.
Seen it, but I wanted to see it based on your recommendation.
It's so actually. Good. Yeah, it's so good.
I see it too.
I think you guys, I mean, it's right up your alley. This guy is like, he was total minimalist kind of guy. So
it's awesome. Yeah. I got to check it out.
Sweet. So, where can people find you? I mean, obviously you guys have a podcast. How often are you releasing new episodes?
We do one a week.
Yeah,
Once a week. Yeah. If people want to find out more about us, they can just go to theminimalists.com, check us out on our podcast.
And what's the latest book?
The most recent one was a book called Everything That Remains. We're working on something right now, but it's not formed enough to talk about it, I don't think. But
Is the most recent one in Audible format as well?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So all three books are audiobooks as well. So if you prefer to listen to books, then they're pretty good on audio as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys. Appreciate
thanks for having
you coming
us.
On the show.
Thanks, Kevin.
Dude, our pleasure, man. Thank you.
All right, that is it for this episode. Hope you enjoyed it. The number one thing you could do to help me out is to head on over to Instagram/KevinRose or search for Kevin Rose on Instagram. Follow me up there, because that way you'll just get notified when I post new shows, new content, and you'll also get to see all the random stuff that I'm up to during the week. Also, if you want to head over to the App Store, and not the App Store, but the iTunes Store, and rate this podcast 5 stars, that would be massive. It gets us more guests on the show, interesting guests on the show, and also gets us exposed to more users. That's it for now. Be well.